Coles was pronounced dead in a hospital 3 days later. Activists are still in disbelief on how the police could treat a member of the society like Nichols as an enemy in the battlefield.
Here I am now in 2023, and I'm looking at another video, this in color, where I'm seeing another black man being beat to death. Rodney didn't die. This is worse. It's beat to death with no mercy on no crime that they can even find that he had committed.
Here at Nichols' funeral, his family desperately called for an end to police brutality against the African-American community.
U.S. Vice President Kamala Harris, who was also present at the funeral, slammed the killing and talked about an act that has a slim chance of getting passed in the Congress. Ironically, U.S. officials have turned up on such occasions in the past and made similar promises, but to no avail. Figures show that police brutality remained as rampant as it had been in the previous years. Law enforcement killed nearly 1,200 people, or about 100 people a month last year, making it the deadliest for police violence. Repeated shooting and lack of transparency have already terrorized America's black community. Many believe the reoccurrence of the brutal scene cannot be prevented by just suspending culprits. No African American will truly become safe from police brutality until its root causes are identified and dealt with.
The most prestigious cinematic event in Iran has kicked off once again, bringing together filmmakers, directors, and members of the cast and crew, as well as movie lovers and moviegoers in Tehran. The 41st edition of the Fajr Film Festival opened with the screening of the movie Maestro by Imad Hosseini, an adaptation of Olina by David Mamet. A clear sign that this year we should be expecting a very different film festival. First and foremost is the conspicuous presence of first-time directors.
24 movies will be competing in the main categories. These movies were picked out of 87 movies that were submitted to the Secretariat. All the 24 movies will be screened first in Tehran and in about a week in 30 provinces across the country. The screenings will continue until February 12th.
But that is not all. In the international section, nearly 24 movies are also taking part. For many of them, this is a regional movie premiere, which is why, as always, the spotlight is on the festival and movies participating in it.
The first days of the festival can tell you a lot about what's going to happen, and by the looks of things, I'm personally expecting to watch some really great movies this year.
Movies will be competing for the top award or the Crystal Seymour in six different sections based on their stories. The Cinema of Salvation, Resistance, Muhammad Amin, and Eastern Vista being the most competitive sections, with all eyes watching to see which movies will take home the Crystal Seymour.
For movie lovers and moviegoers, this is the time to be in Tehran. However, in less than a week, on February the 5th, movie theaters across the country will also be joining in. Gisumisha Ahmadi, Tehran.
The situation for refugees in and around the European Union is getting worse by the day. At a meeting of EU lawmakers in Brussels on Wednesday, it was announced tougher controls will be used on the border between EU member Bulgaria and non-member Turkey.
Like drones and radar and other means of surveillance. As we've done last year, for example, in the last years, for example, in Romania, we've done it in Spain and Greece and in Poland.
EU institutions and leaders are accused of breaking international law surrounding the protection of refugees.
What is the EU answer to these protection gaps? More walls, more drones, more returns, more funding to Libyan detention centres.
Campaigners say shunned refugees are fleeing countries destabilised by the West. At the same time, millions of Ukrainians are being welcomed here and given the same rights as EU citizens.
This is a clear, hypocritic, racist, organized policy that the EU practicing. And this is not a new thing. This is an historical discrimination that the EU stands for as an imperialist power in the world.
Legislators are calling on EU leaders to provide safe, legal routes for refugees.
We need to guarantee the right to asylum for those who need shelter so they are not shamefully piled up in refugee camps or illegally pushed back or drowned in the Mediterranean Sea.
The EU is currently developing a new asylum policy, but it's already shrouded in scepticism.
The Commission has to step up to break the cycle of mistrust existing between member states by enforcing also rules, also current rules.
Many EU nations are now struggling to accommodate the millions of Ukrainian refugees who have travelled here. Thousands more continue to arrive each day. Agencies across the EU that are already overwhelmed warn breaking point is being reached. They are demanding additional resources from governments. Jerome Hughes at the European Parliament, Brussels.
The 44th anniversary of the late Imam Khomeini's return to Iran from several years of exile, marking the beginning of 10 days of celebrations. In Iran, festivities have begun, with Iranians from all walks of life gathering in the mausoleum of Imam Khomeini to renew their pledge of allegiance to the late founder of the Islamic Revolution, while a special ceremony is also underway, demonstrating that the divide-and-rule policy of the enemies of the Islamic Revolution has failed.
I've come here to renew my pledge of allegiance with Imam Khomeini, who was an advocate of social justice and at the forefront of fighting oppressors worldwide.
Assyrians have been living in Iran for more than 3,000 years. This shows that no matter what our enemies do, we will remain united as a nation.
Over the past 44 years, we have managed to overcome many obstacles simply because we remain united, and it's important for our nation to remain that way.
A point that was also raised by the keynote speaker of the ceremony, Parliament Speaker Mohammad Baqir Ghalibaf.
The Islamic Revolution is known worldwide with the name of Imam Khomeini, a great man known for fighting imperialism who always invited the nation to be united in the face of our enemies' plots and said, you know, you're walking down the right path when your enemies do everything they can to stop you. If your enemies are ever indifferent, it is a clear sign that we have deviated from the right path. So their increased animosity is actually a good sign.
That is why the presence of masses at the mausoleum this year is more significant than previous years, considering a period of foreign-backed riots in the country and Western countries increasing political pressure on Iran to unprecedented levels.
We are here to say that we are proud of our revolution and our country.
When Imam Khomeini needed our support to topple the Pahlavi regime, my sons did not hesitate.
I am here to say that I will always support the leader and the Islamic revolution.
My son gave his life for this revolution, and I am here to uphold his values.
Iranians are celebrating the 44th anniversary of the victory of the Islamic Revolution at a time when they've managed to thwart foreign-backed riots in the country and bring peace and calm back to all the cities across Iran. More than anything, the 44th anniversary of the victory of the Islamic Revolution is a show of solidarity. Gisumish Ahmadi, Tehran.
The decision to send German and American tanks to Ukraine is continuing to generate controversy. Many believe the move will prolong the war, and there's concern as to how Russia might respond. However, at a parliamentary hearing on Tuesday, EU legislators were told the West should go even further.
Russia is attacking Ukraine from Russian territory, so obviously we should provide the Ukrainians with long-range missiles, obviously.
There are a lot of EU lawmakers who agree.
Any delay to supply Ukraine with needed weaponry and ammunition
is more lives lost on the battlefield.
Some argue constantly supplying lethal weapons to Ukraine is foolish.
We're prepared to risk nuclear war in order to continue this US-NATO proxy war. It is total madness. And this European Union and the European Parliament have lost the plot. They've lost the run of themselves.
European Union taxpayers have provided 50 billion euro to Kiev since last March.
What happens to all the money we send to Ukraine? Is it just disappearing into individuals' pockets? Even President Zelensky has had to admit there's a big problem with widespread corruption.
A number of legislators would like to see less division within the EU.
Austria and Hungary just decided we will not deliver weapons. Okay, it's their decision. But that shows already some hesitation or some breakup of unity.
Spanish MEP Javier Nart told his colleagues it's, quote, ridiculous to suggest Ukraine can win the war against Russia. For now, the US and Germany have ruled out providing fighter jets to Ukraine. Others, including France, have not. According to many analysts, the risk that the conflict could escalate further and spiral completely out of control has never been greater. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
U.S. Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin visited South Korea this week to reassure officials here that Washington will remain committed to the U.S.-South Korea alliance.
The U.S. commitment to the defense of Korea is ironclad. You heard us say that a number of times, but that's just not a slogan. It is what we're all about. That commitment is ironclad. And our extended deterrence is at the heart of that commitment.
South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol restarted large-scale joint military exercises with the U.S. last year, although the U.S. reportedly deployed its so-called strategic assets, weapons capable of delivering nuclear bombs. The South Korean leader wants more American firepower at his disposal. South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol has repeatedly suggested the need for the U.S. to make a stronger demonstration of extended deterrence, its nuclear umbrella. And the South Korean public has grown skeptical of the U.S. alliance, with a majority now advocating that South Korea develop its own nuclear weapons. The U.S. has also pressured South Korea for greater cooperation with Japan in participation in joint drills. Peace advocates find such a trilateral alliance worrisome.
If the South Korea-U.S. and South Korea-U.S.-Japan alliances are established through cooperative military exercises, the South Korean military will now defend Japan and the U.S. mainland in the Pacific, not South Korea. South Korea will then be reduced to an outpost to protect the United States and Japan.
Meanwhile, earlier this week, NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg visited South Korea to encourage Seoul to send weapons directly to Ukraine. South Korea is exporting weapons to countries that are sending their own military supplies to Ukraine, but has so far refused to provide Kiev with direct military aid. Frank Smith, Seoul.
In a new decree by the Ministry of Higher Education, the Taliban government ordered universities and private institutions in Afghanistan not to enroll women in the entrance exam of 2023. While this decree strengthens a December decree that totally banned women from education, women feel frustrated about their future educations.
When I first heard that we can't enroll for the entrance exam and saw the decree, I felt frustrated. I had high hopes for my future. I feel terrible about that.
I felt like my life had come to an end when I heard this. To be alive is not just to breathe. One must reach their dreams. I felt deeply sorry and not alive.
While the Organization of Islamic Cooperation, with 57 members of Muslim countries, has called the new decree disappointing, Iran's Minister of Foreign Affairs, Hossein Amir Abdullahian, in a press conference expressed his country's readiness to provide any kind of support to Afghanistan in order to restore women's education in the country. Iranian universities had already announced their readiness to hold online classes for the women of Afghanistan. The women in Afghanistan say such a cooperation could be useful.
Once again, we stress that banning girls and women of Afghanistan from education is an improper act and against Islamic teachings. Iran is ready to offer any kind of support needed to upgrade education and reopen schools for the women of Afghanistan in coordination with the interim Afghan government.
Meantime, Afghan women say international community has turned a blind eye to their problems.
Unfortunately, whatever happens in Afghanistan, the international community just condemns it. Online education, on the other hand, is definitely positive, but not as much as face-to-face classes. We women ask the international community to negotiate with the Taliban on reopening the schools.
Education ban in Afghanistan started 500 days ago on girls in 7th to 12th grade, then a ban on universities 2 months ago, and following that, women were banned from working for foreign NGOs and organizations that caused many of these NGOs to stop their mission in Afghanistan. Now, a ban on entrance exam and the question, is there going to be more such restrictions?
In both decrees on women's education ban, a line draws attention saying, until further notice. But nobody really knows if and when this ban will end. Abdullah Mirzadeh, Kabul.
In the limelight.
In the United States, the seven states that rely on the drought-stricken Colorado River failed to meet a 31st of January federal deadline to strike a deal on voluntarily cutting their water use. After negotiations reached a standstill, six of the seven states, namely Arizona, Colorado, Nevada, New Mexico, Utah, and Wyoming, submitted a consensus-based modeling alternative. We take a look at the US media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The website of CNBC has covered this story and tells us more. The seven states that rely on the drought-stricken Colorado River failed to meet a 31st of January federal deadline to strike a deal on voluntarily cutting water use, an impasse that could eventually prompt the Biden administration to impose cuts as the western United States grapples with a historic drought and record low reservoir levels. After negotiations reached a standstill, six of the seven states dependent on the Colorado River instead submitted a proposal to the Bureau of Reclamation that outlined ways to reduce water use and factored in water that's lost because of evaporation and leaky infrastructure. The proposal, titled the Consensus-Based Modeling Alternative, was jointly submitted by Arizona, Colorado, Nevada, New Mexico, Utah, and Wyoming. The proposal notably excluded California, the largest user of the Colorado River water, which supplies water to 40 million people. Officials said the state will release its own plan. The six states document outlined an approach to help protect Glen Canyon Dam and Hoover Dam infrastructure, water deliveries and power production, and prevent the Colorado River's reservoirs from reaching dead pool, which happens when water drops to a level so low that it can't move downstream from the dam. The Colorado River has long been over-allocated, but climate change has worsened drought conditions in the region and reservoir levels have plummeted over the past couple of decades. As the western United States experienced its driest two decades in at least 1,200 years, water levels in the country's two largest reservoirs, that is Lake Mead and Lake Powell, have reached record lows. Sarah Porter, director of the Kyle Center for Water Policy at Arizona State University, said the state's proposal appeared to be a very sincere commitment to advance negotiations over water cuts and keep reservoirs from falling to dangerously low levels. It's easy to overlook how difficult and complex this is for every single state, Sarah Porter said. We have to take less water out of the system, and these are the hardest negotiations to do. Water officials emphasized the proposal was not an official agreement between states, but rather a critical step towards protecting the Colorado River and eventually reaching a seven-state agreement. This modeling proposal is a key step in the ongoing dialogue among seven basin states, as we continue to seek a collaborative solution to stabilize the Colorado River system. Tom Buschatzke, director of the Arizona Department of Water Resources, said in a statement. However, the failure to reach a deal marks the second time in the past 6 months that the seven states using Colorado River water have missed the deadline to agree on cuts under the Interior Department, which manages flows on the river. Historically, states have been the ones to figure out how to share the Colorado River water. But a failure to reach an agreement on reductions could place the responsibility on the federal government. The Biden administration has urged the seven states to save between 2 million and 4 million acre-feet of water, or up to a third of the river's average flow. For comparison, California is entitled to use 4.4 million acre-feet of river water per year, and Arizona is entitled to use 2.8 million acre-feet of water per year. An acre-foot of water is about what two average households consume each year. So far, Arizona has taken the brunt of the government's water reductions, particularly the state's farmers, who grow produce in the desert and use nearly three-quarters of the available water supply to irrigate their crops. The alternative outlined by the six states proposes water cuts that would nearly reach the lower end of 2 million acre-feet that federal officials have urged, with nearly all of the mandatory cuts focused on Arizona, California, and Nevada. The proposal also calls for imposing voluntary conservation measures in Colorado, New Mexico, Utah, and Wyoming. Becky Mitchell, director of the Colorado Water Conservation Board, said this approach appropriately distributes the burden across the basin and provides safeguards for the tribes, for water users, and environmental values in the upper basin. The Bureau of Reclamation is set to release in March a draft of its proposal on how it operates Glen Canyon and Hoover Dams, and will consider the six states' letter as part of that plan. The Associated Press has also covered this story and tells us more. Six western states have agreed on a plan to dramatically cut their water intake from the Colorado River, but California is the lone holdout. Six western states that rely on water from the Colorado River have agreed on a model to dramatically cut their use, months after the federal government called for action and an initial deadline passed. California, with the largest allocation of water from the Colorado River, is the lone holdout. The Colorado River and its tributaries pass through seven states and into Mexico, serving 40 million people and a $5 billion a year agricultural industry. Some of the largest cities in the United States, including the cities of Los Angeles, Phoenix, Denver, and Las Vegas, two Mexican states, Native American tribes, and others, depend on the Colorado River that's been severely stressed by drought, by high demand, and overuse. States missed the mid-August deadline to heed the U.S. Bureau of Reclamation's call to propose ways to conserve 2 million to 4 million acre-feet of water. They regrouped to reach consensus by the end of January to fold into a larger proposal Reclamation has in the works. Arizona, Nevada, New Mexico, Colorado, Utah, and Wyoming sent a letter on Monday, 30th of January, to Reclamation, which operates the major dams in the river system, to outline an alternative that builds on existing guidelines, deepens water cuts and factors in water that's lost through evaporation and transportation. California, however, did not sign onto Monday's agreement, but released a proposal back in October to cut 400,000 acre-feet of water. An acre-foot is enough water to supply 2 to 3 U.S. households for a year. Tina Shields, water manager for California's Imperial Irrigation District, the single largest user of Colorado River water, declined to comment on Monday under basin-wide discussions. But she said any multi-state agreement must be legally defensible. Tina Shields said, frankly, that's what the priority system was set up for, to make long-term planning decisions. We have done so in California and looking to solve a larger Colorado River drought by pointing at those with senior water rights isn't fair. Nothing will happen immediately with the consensus reached among the 6 states. However, not reaching a consensus carried the risk of having the federal government alone determine how to eventually impose cuts to water use. By not signing on the deal, California doesn't avoid that risk.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Iran's Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian has visited Venezuela. Both he and the Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro pledged closer ties, especially in the face of U.S. pressure. This is while the Iranian Foreign Minister also visited Nicaragua and pledged the same with its president. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at how Iran continues to establish relationships with countries not only in South America but beyond to forge ties free from U.S. influence, especially when it comes to U.S.'s far-reaching illegal sanctions. First, let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. America joins us from the capital, Tehran. Also joining us is Arnold August, author and journalist, who joins us from Montreal.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both, Hamid Shahrabi. I'll first start with you, taking a look at the meeting that's taken place between the Iranian foreign minister and, of course, Venezuela. Both are stated goal of the meeting was to enhance their cooperation, but more importantly, in the bigger picture, to thwart cruel sanctions, especially the ones from the U.S. Is that what we're looking at in terms of the significance of this meeting, the bigger picture? Is how they can cooperate together in order to not have U.S. sanctions affect their trade relationship at a minimum?
Yes, it is what you just mentioned. It is that, of course, it is that, but plus other things. Without exaggerating, I think this type of visits at this time, at this epoch, the time that we live, indicates further fundamental developments in the world political relationship among nations. I mean, more explicitly, imperialist countries versus independent nations. In that sense, we are witnessing signals of disintegration of the monopolar system and coming to birth and expansion of multipolar systems. And in this picture, countries that were once as totally subordinated, totally colonized, and exploited by the imperialist camp are playing a role, are establishing relationships based on their national sovereignty, their will to develop their country based on their national resources, based on their independent thinking and planning. This is what is happening, which is great, which is very important, especially as you just mentioned, from the point of view of sanctions. Both countries, Iran and Venezuela, are under sanctions, and they both have immense, without exaggeration, immense capacities in order to be exploited in the road of cooperation between the two countries.
Sure.
Unlimited capacity. I don't want to go further. No problem.
We won't get further. We obviously just started this conversation. Arnold August, you had the Venezuelan president visit Iran recently, of which there was a 20-year agreement that was signed between the two. These are long-term agreements that Iran has had with a number of countries at this point, such as Russia and China. But why Venezuela, do you think? I mean, what do you see this relationship in terms of not just a trade partner, but one that Iran saw, and then Venezuela, obviously, or maybe mutually, came up with the fact that there needs to be a solidification happening in the form of a 20-year agreement?
Yes, as you say, a solidification is necessary. And I was very heartened to see, watch on television, a visit of the foreign minister of Iran, Amir Abdullahian, in Caracas. It seemed only yesterday, I believe, but it was a long time ago, when we together covered President Maduro's historic visit to Tehran, which resulted in a multi-year, multifaceted cooperation agreement. But what is happening now the two countries and the leaders of both countries, Iran and Venezuela, do not seem to be leaving anything to chance. The foreign minister went all the way to Caracas, obviously, to, as they say in their communique, to make that historic agreement even more concrete and also to expand it in the situation that it, since the visit of President Maduro to Tehran, the sanctions against Iran have increased. So all the more reason now to step up and make that historic agreement even more concrete. And I also think what you said is right, more than just trade. I think that increasingly, and this perhaps is not recognized enough on the international sphere, is that in terms of politics, in terms of outlook, the Iranian government and the Maduro government are coming closer to closer and closer. For example, in the president of Iran's first speech to the United Nations General Assembly a short while ago, he said we should not choose between morality and capitalism. In other words, against capitalism and in favor of unipolarity. And I think President Maduro, if I just finish on that one point, I think it's very important. He made a very important speech, an interview with Ignacio Aramonet on January 1st, 2023, in which he said, talking about the issue of Ukraine, he said, this is part of the labor pains of a world that will emerge. I think that's very, very significant. Both Iran and President Iran and Venezuela are very strong political voices in the world today against U.S. hegemony.
Well, one of the things, as you said, in a changing world that we're seeing here, if I'm correct to interpret it that way, Hamid, is looking at the way that Iran delivered these fuel tankers to Venezuela and delivered oil or oil condensate. I'm not too sure what form it was in. But the mere fact that it made this journey on a number of occasions to Venezuela, it was highly publicized. And, of course, the U.S. was looking on because, obviously, both countries are under severe sanctions. Wasn't that a big deal in the sense that it sent out a message that here we are, we're breaking the U.S. sanctions, and you, the U.S., can't do anything about it, delivering the product to Venezuela on a number of occasions. Do you think that that was an important thing that happened?
Yes.
No, this is for Hamid Shahrabi.
Oh, Hamid, sorry. Go ahead, Hamid.
No, it's okay.
Yes. Well, a short comment on that is, you know, as the authorities of both countries and the solid statistics indicate, this deal between Iran and Venezuela in regard to oil, and further than that, in regard to renovating the oil refineries, has proved to increase the production capacity of Venezuela in regard to oil production, in regard to refinery of the oil. And this is not only important from the economic point of view, which in itself it is important from that point of view, but it goes further, as you just mentioned. The whole world witnessed with their own eyes that despite the will and the dictates of the United States, two independent nations are cooperating and are trading, ignoring the illegal and illegitimate sanctions and benefiting from the capacities of each country. That was great, and it happened, and they couldn't do anything about it. Look at it, in reality. They couldn't do anything about it, which demands further discussion, going to the point that why they couldn't. It is, let me put it this way. What other events shall we look for to see this disintegration of the hegemony of imperialism? This is what is happening.
Sure.
But allow me to say that when you mentioned the comprehensive agreement, joint agreement for cooperation in different areas, although this is very important to reach these agreements, it's more important to implement and expand such agreements and to consider factors blocking and intervening in okay. such a way to block such agreements. I'm talking about the United States forces and all the political forces allied to it.
Sure. Well, this is part of the changing landscape, but Iran has been on this for a while when it comes to Latin America. Arnold August, another important trip that the Iranian foreign minister did make was to Nicaragua. And the headlines read, Iran-Nicaragua vow to confront common enemy sanctions, of course, in reference to the U.S. sanctions, and how they will be able to manage to, conduct trade by going about a route where, again, the sanctions won't have an effect. The part of the changing landscape is what has been in motion for quite some time when it comes to Iran, and it wants to expand that to countries that have been a victim of U.S. sanctions. But in particular, we're seeing Iran being rather, not aggressive, but being very much into establishing this type of relationship with Latin American countries. Brazil is another one where Iran does have good relationships with Brazil, especially with the now president at the time before that, even during the Ahmadinejad, former president of Iran's tenure, we had good relationship with Brazil then. So are we seeing a new front with Latin American countries when it comes to their relationship with Iran?
Yes, we are definitely seeing a new front. But just to add on that one point, on the seven tankers that were heroically sent by Iran to Venezuela, that took place before the war in Ukraine. And now, since the war, the move towards multipolarity, opposition to U.S. hegemony is even stronger. And I was very happy to see that in addition to Iran, the foreign minister of Iran went to Nicaragua because Daniel Ortega is one of the most outspoken, clear voice against U.S. hegemony and also, I shall say, against any unreasonable conciliation between Latin America and the United States. He insists Latin America has to be safe. It has to be safe. It has to be sovereign. And that you know, was an important stop in this current trip by the Iranian foreign minister. And yet Latin America is becoming extremely important. Of course, when we talk about international alliances, we mention anti-hegemic alliances. We mention Iran, Russia, China. But we also cannot omit to mention secondary countries, especially in Latin America. For example, Venezuela, with its strong voice against U.S. imperialism, is playing an important role. And even smaller, Nicaragua is playing that important role. And of course, Brazil, which is big, now is into the BRICS, which will soon include other countries such as Iran and Turkey, etc. All these new configurations on the world scale, many of them based in Latin America, is going to provide a further impulse towards multipolarity, and we should not underestimate the role of smaller countries such as Venezuela, Nicaragua, and Cuba, etc., Bolivia, in pushing against the U.S. hegemony. People have lost their fear about being decoupled from the United States. On the contrary, you know, we talk about trends, we talk about fashion trends. Well, there's a trend in the world today to decouple sure. from the United States and Europe. This is very significant.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Sure. Well, it's interesting. Hamid Chahrabi, our guest there, when he talked about Russia, Iran, and Venezuela. I want to add those three countries and then put China in that mix and ask you about how the four altogether represents, when you take a look at their oil and gas reserves, about 40% of the world capacity. So that kind of forms a block, because they are all on the same page when it comes to the way that they are standing up against the U.S. Shouldn't the U.S. be worried that when you have that amount of natural energy reserves in one camp with these four countries, that it therefore would pose some kind of a challenge for the U.S. when it comes to its energy needs, along with people or countries that are aligned with the U.S., in particular European countries?
Well, this is the general picture as you draw it. That is true. We are talking about the strong countries when it comes to different aspects, mainly here what you're talking about, the energy, the source of energy, the oil, the place of Venezuela in that regard, Russia in that regard, Iran in that regard. And what is interesting, again, as you mentioned, is not much that United States can do about it. See, the history has not been always like this. They have dominated, they have ordered, they have dictated. And this is not possible any longer. The countries decide for themselves, and powerful countries. As you mentioned, I mean, this cooperation between Iran and the Latin American countries, I think when you bring to picture other possibilities, such as investment by China mainly, to become part of this cooperation, to join this cooperation, creates miracles, creates conditions for development, real development of the countries which have been for centuries deprived of development based on their natural resources, based on their human power, based on the other wealth of their countries. This is happening right in front of our eyes. But what is important, I think, beside mentioning this reality, is to be at the same time critical on where we can be when it is compared to where we are. I'm talking about it, like when you compare the amount of trade between Iran and Venezuela, Iran and Nicaragua, Iran and Cuba, although it is it's been improving, but is negligible. Mm-hmm. It is quite negligible when you lose. And I really think it's a grand occasion for academic centers, for revolutionary forces to make serious studies on how to expand such win-win cooperations. Sure. We have been hearing about win-win. For decades, for centuries, we have had relationship with metropolitan cities and countries in the West, that it has been all the way win from one side and lose from the other side, which sure. is us. We have lost all the time in that relationship. And now the situation has been changed. We can, this can happen, that when we look at the natural resources, instead of only looking at Iran, we bring into picture all these natural resources in Latin America and the planning and the capabilities of each country. Let's talk about Iran. We have great technology know-how in regard to which could be transferred to good sure. infrastructure in poor countries and or deprived countries of Latin America.
Okay, so Arnold August, you noticed the way that our guests there talked when it came to Iran and other countries. The issues or points that he made were in terms of advancement of trade, in terms of sharing technology, in terms of sharing the natural resources between Iran and, well, in this case, we talked about Latin American countries. But when it comes to the U.S., we're not hearing that type of talk, really. Are we? I mean, you know, it's the U.S. is always on this path where it wants countries to align with its foreign policy, and if it doesn't, it's a black and white issue. If you don't listen to us, sanctions. We're going to give you, you're going to go under sanctions, right? I mean, it just seems to be that way. And I think countries are tired of that. And I think countries are saying, if we want to deal with the U.S., it doesn't mean we have to listen to the U.S. We also want to advance with other countries, such as Iran, such as Russia, perhaps, such as China. Again, every country for itself. But that's where the shift is going. Taking a look at, for example, Brazilian president, Lula da Inácio da Silva, in his first trip abroad, he went to Argentina. And one of the things he talked about was that common currency in a move away from the dollar. The U.S. is watching all this happening. What can the U.S. do?
Just to add what Hamid said about the cooperation between Iran and Venezuela, there's an aspect that is very important in that long-term agreement that was signed a few months ago, in addition to technology, economics, to also expand direct links between the people of Iran and the people of Venezuela, with a direct flight, I believe, I think it's once a week, from Tehran to Caracas. This will help a lot for people in Iran to visit and get to know Venezuela and vice versa. This will help to solidify the relationship almost as much as the economic common interest. Now, you also asked the following question. Should the U.S. Be afraid about what is happening now in terms of certain countries and regions opposing U.S. hegemony? Yes, of course, they are afraid. And I believe one of the reasons, one of the manifestations of their fear of this a growing multilateral world was to use NATO and Ukraine to attack Russia. For what purpose? To destabilize and weaken Russia, as well as destabilize and weaken the growing Russian-Chinese alliance. Now, of course, the United States had that to fear, and that's how they went into action in Ukraine. But I think we, the peoples of the world, we also have something to fear, because even though the United States is definitely losing its grip on the world, no one can have any illusion that the U.S. imperialism, that has been so used to being the top dog in the world for so many decades, they are not going to take this lying down. We can expect important other war provocations, which has to be opposed by the peoples of the world, progressive governments.
Okay. All right. Taking a look at the last question, since we're almost out of time over here, Hamid Shabrabi. We're not just noticing a shift when it comes to Latin American countries vis-a-vis the U.S., and then, of course, Iran being one of the countries establishing relations with these Latin American countries. We're looking at the U.S. also falling behind in Africa. I'm kind of switching the focus here when it comes to countries like Russia and China and their foothold in that continent. African countries also are not so keen to further develop and enhance their ties with the U.S. because they are also seeing this shift. And, of course, both Russia and China, especially China, has expanded itself through many trade sectors with different countries in Africa. And Iran is very keen to establish itself with African countries also. So my final question to you is, we are seeing this shift that's happening around the globe somewhat when it comes to the U.S. being left out, aren't we? In less than a minute, please.
Would you please repeat the last part of your sentence?
We're seeing the U.S. somewhat left out in the dark. We're not seeing the U.S. being part of any new trade blocks. As a matter of